Iran says a deal under the revival JCPOA is very much within reach if the U.S. understands that Iran would not back down on its demands. Russia calling for a U.N. Security Council meeting on a, quote, provocation by Ukrainian radicals in Bucha. This after Kiev accused Moscow of massacre in the city. Israeli forces attack Palestinians in the occupied East Al-Quds, wounding a dozen of them and arresting many more. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. The top story this hour, Iran saying that the U.S. needs to make up its mind as regards the JCPOA and make necessary political decisions as soon as possible if it wants the 2015 deal to be revived. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says Washington has made JCPOA hostage to its internal policies. He says the administration of President Biden has so far followed in the footsteps of the Trump administration. He said an agreement in Vienna will be within reach if the U.S. understands that Iran won't abandon its demands. Tehran and the remaining sides to the 2015 deal have been engaged in talks in the Austrian capital since last year. Iran has stressed that a JCPOA revival depends on the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington won't abandon the accord again, as it did in 2018. Now over to Ukraine, 40 days into the Russian conflict there. Moscow focusing its attack on Ukraine's south and east after withdrawing from areas near capital Kiev. Airstrikes at two port cities in the south, that's Mykolaiv and Odessa. Moscow says an oil refinery and three fuel storage facilities used by Ukrainian forces were destroyed in Odessa. Kiev says the attacks left one person dead and 14 injured in Mykolaiv. Officials also say that seven people were killed and 34 more wounded after a residential area was hit in the eastern city of Kharkiv. Inside Russia, two blasts have reportedly ripped through the city of Belgorod near the border with Ukraine. Russia's foreign ministry says that the footage of recently revealed mass graves in the Ukrainian town of Bucha is part of a plot to blame Moscow. Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova says the footage was ordered by the United States. Russia had earlier said that the forces did not kill the civilians. Moscow also asked the UN Security Council to discuss, quote, the provocation by Ukrainian radicals. Kiev's officials say the mass graves near the capital city contain hundreds of civilian bodies. They say the victims were executed by Russian troops. Kiev has called for a probe of the alleged massacre by the International Criminal Court. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has also called for an independent inquiry, saying it must lead to effective accountability. The Kremlin says it is not possible to completely isolate Russia as the West continues piling up sanctions on Moscow over its military operation in Ukraine. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says it's technologically impossible in the modern world to fully isolate Russia. He says the world is much larger than Europe, adding sooner or later, we will have to build a dialogue whether some overseas want it or not. Western capitals have slapped unprecedented economic sanctions on Moscow since it moved troops into Ukraine on February 24th. There are also travel bans and asset freezes on a number of government figures, including President Putin. Now, we've spoken to historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling about the impact of Western sanctions on the Kremlin, and he believes that such punitive measures will be futile.
We've got the leaders in the West are lying to themselves and to each other that they can actually discipline Russia and discipline Putin by sanctions. And of course, this is never going to work, and it can't work because over many years now, the Russians and other countries that have been sanctioned have actually in some ways grown more independent and stronger through those sanctions. And I'm afraid it's indicative of the total lack of reality at the top. Of course, this is something which we who live in Western countries are very well aware of. We've seen complete mismanagement of our economies and the collapse, say, for example, here in Britain, of industries which were just simply allowed to be sold abroad. And we've got a population now which is at the highest poverty level since the end of the Second World War.
Hungary's opposition leader, Peter Márkizé, has conceded defeat in the parliamentary elections, but he links the victory of Prime Minister Orbán's ruling party to its vast propaganda machine.
We recognize their victory. We recognize that in a system like this, whatever kind of election system there would be, whatever kind of election math there would be, the ruling party would have had a strong victory. They would have had a two-thirds victory.
Márkizé's remark comes after Orbán declared his right-wing party winning two-thirds of the parliamentary seats. With 94% of votes counted, official results show Orbán's party leading with around 53%. The opposition alliance has mustered some 35% of the vote. The premier's party is also headed in single-number constituencies. Orbán, who will lead the country for a fourth consecutive term, has already blamed his opponents for trying to drag Hungary into the Ukraine conflict. He also banned any transport of Western arms to Ukraine via Hungary. The election is held amid rising inflation. Consumer prices has jumped to an almost 15-year high in February. In an effort to remind voters of the past 5 years, scores of yellow vest protesters have marched in Paris. The first round of presidential elections next weekend, with polls showing an increasingly tight re-election for President Emmanuel Macron. Rami Mazahari has more.
Exactly 1 week before the first round of the French election, the embodiment of the past 5 years marched in Paris. Yellow vests who were crippled, blinded, and mutilated by police. On every Saturday from November 2018 until June 2019, a national bloodletting took place on a scope which was unprecedented in recent Western history. The numbers are as staggering as the lack of Western condemnation for the French government. At least 11,000 arrests, 1,000 imprisoned, 5,000 protesters seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 deaths. Those who suffer the most say they don't want to be forgotten when voters go to the ballot box.
When you're mutilated by the police, there's naturally a lot of suffering and a lot of complications to our daily lives. But we keep our head held up high to show what Mr. Macron has done to his own people.
The huge phalanx of armed police, which still accompany the yellow vests every Saturday, kept their distance, while the mainstream media was not present at the protest almost at all.
It is the average citizens who supports us, because we do not even exist to this state or to the justice system. Where there is no police brutality and there are no victims, then how can we exist?
Over 75% of cases involving hurt protesters are immediately dropped without any court case or even an investigation. Punishment of police for mistreating yellow vest anti-government protesters has been almost non-existent.
By denying that there was any police brutality, the government legitimized it. How can we have confidence in a government which cripples its own citizens or in institutions which do not intervene to stop that? It is truly barbaric violence which chose to mutilate people simply because they believe in a better future.
The yellow vests are routinely credited with an approval rating of 75%, an unheard-of score in a country where perceptions of political corruption are commonplace. The state-sponsored police brutality, combined with the so-called anti-yellow vest laws, scared many into no longer attending public protests. President Emmanuel Macron is expected to win a close re-election, but the damage to France's international reputation cannot be estimated. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Now, other news, Israeli forces have intensified crackdown on Palestinians during the holy months of Ramadan. They attack fasting people in East Al-Quds, injuring around a dozen of them, and arresting many more. According to Palestinian media, people were violently attacked as they were gathering for night prayers. The forces reportedly used rubber bullets and tear gas in their attack in front of Damascus Gate in the Old City area. Resistance movement Hamas has denounced the attack, which it says followed a top Israeli official's visit to Damascus Gate. The group calls it a dangerous escalation. At least 10 Palestinians have been killed and dozens more arrested during a week-long Israeli raids across the occupied territories. Last year, Israeli forces attacked on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque that resulted in 11 days of deadly conflict between the regime and Hamas. Yemen says it's committed to a UN-brokered ceasefire with the Saud-led coalition as long as the other side does the same. According to the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, all offensive military operations, including ground, aerial, and naval attacks by the two sides, have been stopped for a two-month period. Abdul Latif al-Bashali has a report from Sana'a.
As Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan, a new truce was announced by the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen to help the humanitarian situation in the country. The parties agreed to a nationwide ceasefire for 2 months, in addition to suspending all sorts of aerial attacks from both parties.
The international community has become convinced that this unjustified and barbaric aggression against the Yemeni people must be stopped, and the violations and crimes left by the war are a disgrace to the international community. There are indications of the continuation of the truce, and we hope that it will be the beginning of a complete end to the war and the lifting of the siege on Yemen so that we can confront the humanitarian crisis.
The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for 2 flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan only, and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hudaydah Port. However, observers say this agreement is the result of the recent attacks of Yemen's armed forces against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia.
I think, of course, those latest attack against Saudi Arabia and as well in the last few months against United Arab Emirates, it has forced Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates to accept this truce. But it will be really clear in the coming days and week, will they accept this and will they, because there have been many like agreement that has been signed as an example in Stockholm. But still at that time, because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were not part of this agreement, they have not signed and they were not mentioned in any of those agreements. That's why they have actually not respecting them.
In addition to the war, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the all-out blockade it imposes on Yemen and has prevented Yemen's fuel ships to enter the country. This has worsened the situation in war-torn Yemen, which is already going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation of their country, Yemenis say there has always been light despite all the darkness. They believe the UN brokered agreement may lead to a comprehensive political solution as the Saudi war must come to an end. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The grisly murder of dissident journalists at the hands of Saudi agents in Istanbul left the world in disbelief. Evidence started to emerge suggesting the involvement of the Saudi government and Crown Prince in the cold-blooded murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And if there was any chance of justice to be served, it lay in the hands of Turkey, where the assassination took place. Yet things are now changing, with President Erdogan planning to close the case in Turkey and turn it over to Saudi Arabia.
A Turkish prosecutor has requested to halt the trial for Jamal Khashoggi's murder in Istanbul and transfer it to Saudi Arabia, some 4 years after the dissident Saudi journalist was murdered in Turkey. The court requested the Justice Ministry's opinion on the issue and is expected to rule on the request at its next hearing, set for April 7th. The Saudi Chief Public Prosecutor's Office had requested the transfer, and evidently the Turkish courts are planning to comply. Turkey's justice minister said earlier that his ministry would approve a request to transfer a trial over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi to Saudi Arabia. Human rights groups have condemned the move, saying Riyadh cannot be expected to hold a fair trial for the alleged killers of the journalist. In 2020, Saudi Arabia jailed 8 people for between 7 and 20 years for Khashoggi's murder. None of the defendants was named in what rights groups described as a sham trial. Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. A U.S. intelligence report released a year ago said Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had approved the operation to kill Khashoggi. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said the murder had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government, an accusation that has already strained the relations between the two countries and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish goods, which cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. The request by the Turkish prosecutor comes as Turkey seeks to mend ties with Saudi Arabia.
The Saudis absolutely have both an economic and a political interest in further ties to Turkey and Erdogan. I think it is a relationship where both of them are looking to get out of their tough situations, both politically and economically. There is political devastation and economic devastation, specifically in Turkey, and there is an clear economic interest to Prince Salman of Saudi Arabia and various other figures in both Saudi Arabia and Turkey to increase these ties that are beneficial for the United States and for other Western vassal states in the Middle East.
Rights activists believe that the Turkish president appears to be sacrificing justice for economic interests. They say Erdogan wants to reap the financial rewards of a closer relationship with Riyadh, just as he has done with the UAE. And given Turkey's reset with Israel and in close cooperation with the U.S., the president may also be thinking about his political future and the balance of power in the region. Now, moving on, China has given one of its biggest ever public health responses to the COVID outbreak. The government is sending the military and thousands of healthcare workers into Shanghai to help execute COVID tests for 26 million people. The army has dispatched more than 2,000 of its medical personnel to Shanghai. According to estimates, some 10,000 healthcare workers have also been sent there. Shanghai has reported over 9,000 new cases only on Sunday. China's most populous city has grounded to halt after the government locked it down last week. The measure is aimed at stopping an outbreak of the highly transmissible Omicron variant that has started more than a month ago. Mass resignations in Sri Lanka. Cabinet members have resigned following escalating anti-government protests and a deepening economic crisis. 26 ministers submitted letters of resignation on Sunday. President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and the Prime Minister have not resigned. They are set to introduce a new cabinet soon. They have invited all political parties to join the government and find a solution to the country's economic meltdown. Sri Lanka is currently under a state of emergency. Security forces are bracing for potentially violent rallies. Access to the majority of social media platforms has also been blocked. Sri Lanka is witnessing its most powerful downturn since gaining independence from Britain in 1948, facing severe shortages of food and fuel, record inflation, and mounting foreign debts. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I'm driving towards the city of Qazvin. Let me turn down the music. It's okay now. Thought you couldn't hear me. I was saying, today we were going to visit an old attractive caravanserai in Qazvin. Saad al-Saltaneh Caravanserai. Qazvin is one of the central cities of Iran. This city is located 153 kilometers from Tehran. Qazvin was the capital city of Iran for 57 years during the Safavid era. That is why this city has many historical monuments. Saad al-Saltaneh Caravanserai is one of these historical monuments. This caravanserai was built in Qajarid era at the time of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. Saad al-Saltaneh Caravanserai is the largest in-town roofed caravanserai of Iran. The reconstruction of this caravanserai took 20 years, and some parts of it are still being reconstructed. Saad al-Saltaneh Caravanserai has four semi-domes. Unlike other roofed caravanserais, its ceilings doesn't have any light well. The architecture of this unique historical monument has an introvert character. This caravanserai has six interconnected sara, including Sadiye, Saad al-Saltaneh, Negar al-Saltaneh, Qahramani, Beheshti, and Rasteye Vazir. A sara is an Iranian traditional structure including both indoor and outdoor sections. Normally, all the rooms are around facing the courtyard. These saras are brick-made and have great Iranian architecture. I am now at the entrance corridor of the caravanserai. This corridor has several brick-made vaults. It's fantastic. The bricks are beautifully decorated. From this point, I can't see the courtyard. I always wanted to see this magnificent historical building. Happy to see it today. Saad al-Saltaneh Caravanserai has seven courtyards, and I am now in one of these courtyards. Very pretty. This courtyard is surrounded by some chambers. Oh, look! There is a very beautiful statue in the middle of the courtyard. The statue of a man riding on a camel, staring at an uncertain point in the sky. He seems to be a merchant of the Qajar dynasty. I guessed it from his outfit. And I am now in the most valuable part of the building, which is called Chahar Sogh. For your information, Chahar Sogh is an area which is said to have a quadrilateral space that can be indoors or open. And just above my head, there is a large dome decorated by tiles. It's gorgeous. The blue and turquoise tiles remind me of the sky. Our Iranian architecture is full of wonders and beauties. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavit Tapley. It was a first in Pakistan's history. For the first time, parliamentarians in its parliament chanted death to America. Now, this occurred while there was a no-confidence vote to oust Prime Minister Imran Khan, which was rejected. Why is it that Pakistani lawmakers are saying foreign powers are interfering in the country's democratic process, including the Prime Minister? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether this is the case and what Pakistan intends to do about its relation with the U.S. First, let's find out about all the developments that happened. Kamran Yusuf is our correspondent who joins us from Islamabad. Well, there's quite a bit of ground for you to cover for us here. If you can highlight what actually occurred today.
Well, it was quite an unprecedented and a tumultuous day in the history of Pakistan. And the National Assembly of Pakistan was supposed to vote on a no-confidence motion moved by the opposition parties, but the government had other ideas. When the session started, the country's law minister stood up and stated that the speaker should not allow the vote of no confidence take place, since the government believes that this vote of no confidence was part of a foreign conspiracy to topple the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan, since according to the government, he was pursuing an independent foreign policy. And after listening to the law minister's remarks, the deputy speaker of the National Assembly, who happens to be the member of the ruling party, declared that this move by the opposition parties was not in line with the constitution, and hence he dismissed and did not allow opposition to vote on the vote of no confidence, although opposition had the numbers to unseat Prime Minister Imran Khan. And after that, Prime Minister Imran Khan appeared on a national television and congratulated the nation for what he said, defeating the conspiracy hatched by a foreign power. And then he advised the President of Pakistan to dissolve the National Assembly and announce early election. And now the matter is before the Supreme Court of Pakistan because opposition parties have challenged the ruling of the deputy speaker because they think that the speaker had violated the constitutional provisions.
Thank you for that, Kamian Yusuf, of course, one of them from Islamabad. We appreciate that. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Liaghat Ali Khan. He's the author, academic, and researcher who joins us from Topeka, Kansas. Also joining us is Ashabir Rizvi, managing director of IFSA, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Liaghat Ali Khan, let me first start with you. In your assessment, what occurred in Parliament today was quite unprecedented, just like our correspondent there mentioned. Tell us about some of those developments, what you think it means, especially the fact that at this point we're looking at a Parliament that is dissolved, and then what we're looking at in terms of what the Prime Minister is promoting here.
Yes, thank you. Under the Constitution of Pakistan, when a no-confidence motion is in the National Assembly, the Prime Minister has no constitutional authority to dissolve the Assembly. And the Assembly must vote on the no-confidence motion. So today, on Sunday, this was the last day under the Constitution to vote on the no-confidence motion. But the Prime Minister, he has been arguing that the United States has given money and incentive and help to the opposition parties to overthrow his regime because he has been very close to China and Russia. And I think there is some evidence that the United States is not happy with the Prime Minister, and they won't mind if the Prime Minister is deseated. So to that extent, I think Mr. Khan has a good case. But then he goes further and argues that about 10 political parties, some are very religious parties, some have been anti-American political parties, they all are conspiring with the United States to unseat him. And some 20 members of his own party, so there are like 200 members out of 342 who would like to de-seat the Prime Minister. So I think it's very difficult for people, particularly in the legal community, to accept the assertion that 200 members of the National Assembly and 9 or 10 political parties of Pakistan, they are, they are traitors, the word he uses, and they are trying to overthrow his government because they are conspiring with the United States. So I think what he did is completely, blatantly unconstitutional. And I think the Supreme Court of Pakistan would say so.
So in your opinion, you don't think that what he is claiming is true, the fact that you have all these party members actually cooperating with the U.S.?
I think, I don't know if what he's saying is true or untrue. But that is not the way to resolve the problem.
Sure.
I think if the opposition is actually conspiring with the United States to de-seat him, he needs to produce irrebuttable evidence before some court of law to show that is the case. Mere allegation that 200 members of the National Assembly and mere allegation that 9 political parties are conspiring with the United States to overthrow him, I think that's a big claim.
Right.
And there is no due process to the evidence. There's no due process to the counterclaim of the opposition parties that they are against Prime Minister Khan because his government is incompetent.
Okay.
And stuff like that.
Sure. Let's see what Shabir Rizvi thinks. Shabir Rizvi, we actually have something that's unprecedented, which I'd like to find out from you what you think about it, and that's the fact that you have the chance death to America that happened in Parliament, according to what we have received in reports. And also the fact that the National Assembly Deputy Speaker talking about how no foreign power should be allowed to topple an elected government through a conspiracy. I'm wondering if he's obviously making a reference there to the U.S. And, of course, your thoughts on the chants that were made in Pakistan's parliament.
Hello. Thank you very much, Kaveh. It's good to be back. And best wishes in Ramadan for all of us. Now, look, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, and I'm not an expert on the intricacies of the political parties in Pakistan. But I think what one has to really understand, whether Mr. Imran Khan is using the word conspiracy to strengthen his position or not, we have to look at a bit more in history. The first Prime Minister of Pakistan was assassinated by the CIA back in 1951. And continuously, the USA has interfered in Pakistan. And what one's got to understand is that both the two major parties, the Muslim League and also the Pakistan People's Party, they really have been quite corrupt in the last 30, 40 years. In Pakistan, they have the elite in Pakistan have really impoverished Pakistan, especially the two political dynasties, as I said. So they don't really have a very good record. And I really like to sort of put this in the mix for Pakistani elite who have investments in UK and USA. You can see that what's happened in the last 4 weeks, that some of the oligarchs' assets have been taken over in UK and their bank accounts have been frozen. I hope the Sharifs and the Zardaris and Mr. Bilawal Bhutto and his sister and Maryam Sharif also should take that into account, that sooner or later their assets will be frozen in UK. So whether they want to be traitors to Pakistan, their livelihood and their assets will be taken over by Britain as soon as they are not in the good books of UK and USA.
Sure.
So, the opposition is playing a very tightrope and delicate game themselves.
Okay, so there you have the view in terms of at least the view from our guest there from London, Lighat Ali Khan, about the opposition. But let's zoom in more on the accusations that has been leveled by Prime Minister Khan against the U.S. Now, based on what we have heard, one of the reasons that he believes the U.S. is behind what has happened in Parliament eventually with the no-confidence motion is because of his visit to Russia last month. Do you find that to be credible?
Yes.
Sorry,
I think the United States does not like that Pakistan, which has been an ally for the United States since its creation in 1947. So I think the United States is not happy, like it is not happy with many other countries that do not agree with the United States. And I think as a superpower, superpowers do that, whether it's Russia or China or the United States, they don't like small countries to have independent foreign policy. And I think Pakistan, Prime Minister Khan, he's saying that we want to have an independent foreign policy. Well, that's a very good idea, but the reality is that Pakistan is completely dependent on the West, whether it is the World Bank, whether it's the IMF, whether it is, the defense equipment, in so many ways.
Remittances. So let me jump in there. Let me jump in there, Lighat Ali Khan. Ask Kamran Yusuf, Shabir Rizvi, whether he agrees with you on that. Shabir Rizvi, is Pakistan, as much as the Prime Minister wants, a foreign policy independent from the U.S. and the West, Can it do that, or based on what our guest said, that that's just really an idea that can't be done?
Look, Pakistan, like many other countries on this planet, have been impoverished by the elite and also by the superpowers. Now, whether Russia, China, or America act similarly, the experience is that since partition, and particularly when Pakistan took the side of USA under the pretext of fighting terrorism 20 years ago under General Musharraf, that clearly shows that Pakistan has come out a loser. So, you know, the Mr. Sharif, who's the main opposition leader at this moment, says that Pakistan is a poor country and poor countries have no rights. I mean, how dare that a particular leader in Pakistan says that poor countries have no rights? Therefore, the, you know, all poor countries should forget about it. And Iran next door to Pakistan is a very good example that for the last 43 years, it had stood up against Iran, against USA.
Right.
And of course, sanctions have blighted the nation. It has created all kinds of problems. But at the end of the day, whether the West dislikes Iran or not, they respect Iran.
Sure.
While Pakistan, because of its own leaders, has no respect in London, Paris, or Washington. And that's what I think Imran Khan and some of the other leaders are trying to sort of get Pakistan to be a respected nation and not to be a vassal of Washington.
Exactly. Yeah, Ali Khan, to break this open more, based again on news that we have, Pakistan's ambassador to Washington actually said that he has recorded a senior U.S. official.
Hello?
This is for Liaghat Ali Khan. Pakistan's ambassador.
Hello, I can't hear you.
To Washington, who has recorded a senior U.S. official telling him they felt relations would be better if Khan left office. I mean, that goes beyond that goes beyond just not having a country aligned with your foreign policy, in the case of the U.S., to want Khan to leave office. Again, if this is true, which we believe that it is, do you think that that is the way U.S. approaches it? Their track record speaks as such.
Absolutely. I think there's no doubt about that. All superpowers and even middle powers, they want to influence other nations. Actually, let me say it to you, not even the United States, the superpower, can pursue an independent foreign policy. This whole concept of independent foreign policy is passé. It's not valid. I think the nations are so mutually dependent that no country, no matter how strong, can pursue an independent foreign policy. So as a smart nation, not a foolish nation, as a smart nation, you have to see the enmeshment of the world. You have to understand that the world is no longer, you know, not united. It is united, sometimes in a pathological way, that we are dependent on each other, and there's hierarchy in the international community. So I think as a smart nation, you don't defy superpowers. You work with them, mm-hmm. and you make your case without destroying yourself. I think Saddam Hussein did that. Mr. Gaddafi did that. I think I would appreciate Iran is very smart. I think they fight in a beautiful way,
right?
In my view, that they resist, but they don't destroy their nation. And I think Pakistan should do the same.
Well, the problem is who makes a nation a superpower? The definition of that is where I think most of the problem is. So let me get to Shabir Rizvi here. Shabir Rizvi, let's really look at what has happened here when it comes to Imran Khan vis-a-vis the U.S. One of the problems that existed between the two, which was very big, was on the issue of Afghanistan. One of the tweets that Khan actually sent out was that to the U.S., said, "The U.S., we will be your friend, not your slave. We will help you withdraw from Afghanistan, but we will not launch military operation for you." That's just one of the stances of Imran Khan. So the U.S. obviously does not particularly care for Khan. Is that a correct conclusion to make on the relationship between Khan and the U.S.?
But look, it's becoming very clear that the direction that Imran Khan wants to take Pakistan, unlike the previous, the two political parties that I talked about. They have really sold their soul very cheaply for their children to be educated in UK and USA and to buy properties in this part of the world. In reality, they've had no love for their nation as such, other than sort of lining their pockets. Coming back to the issue of our friend talking about that no nation has independent policy, yes, I tend to agree with him to a degree. However, independence means that trying to do things that are in the benefit of one's nation and people. Now, if that is a definition of being independent, fine. Otherwise, all nations have to work together. But what we have to really look at is the track record that the USA has in Pakistan and also globally, you know, whether it's sort of color revolutions in Ukraine that happened, as we know, or more recently in Kazakhstan and all over the place. And also assassinations are part of the baggage that USA carries if they do not try to remove a leader by a color revolution or by other conspiratorial methods, then they assassinate. IND is a good example. Lumumba in Congo is a good example. And I can go on and on and on for another hour listing where USA has assassinated other leaders. China, as far as I know, hasn't done that in the last few years. As far as I know, Russia, even in the previous Soviet Union, hasn't done that. So the really... Okay.
These two countries that you mentioned, I'd like to come to Liaquat Ali Khan and ask him. Liaquat Ali Khan, we're looking at China's relationship with Pakistan. Obviously a very close relationship. The Belt and Road Initiative has given Pakistan quite a bit of investment within the country, which has been ongoing for quite some time. And obviously Pakistan has long enjoyed diplomatic and business relationships with China. Again, multi-billion dollar development deals that they have had. The U.S. obviously does not like that either. So if you put Russia and then put this next to each other, and of course the way that Prime Minister Imran Khan has criticized the U.S. in terms of the way they operated in Afghanistan, and saying that Pakistan could have done more. Again, more reason for the U.S. to, according to Imran Khan, want him out?
I think if you want to criticize the United States or any other superpower, you should be an academic. But if you are the prime minister of a country or if you're the president of a country, then your criticism is within the bounds of pragmatism. Then the interest of your country is superior to the morality of behavior. And I think this is where Mr. Khan, who himself has a very interesting background, he has been a playboy for many decades. And now, you know, he has a tasbih in his hand and he is now, you know, peddling Islam. And I think he has every right to do so. But as the prime minister of a nuclear powered country, whose economic power is very bad, he has to be pragmatic in his criticism, in his behavior, in his criticism of the United States particularly, mm-hmm. with which Pakistan has the highest international trade. And a lot of money comes from the United States in many forms. So simply from a pragmatic viewpoint, the prime minister cannot challenge the United States. And I think Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, when he detonated the nuclear bombs, President Clinton asked him not to do so. There was a lot of pressure on Nawaz not to detonate the nuclear bombs, but he did. And I think at the same time, he was very understanding and very sort of polite to Pakistan, to the United States.
Sure. Well, let's examine the role, if we can here, Shabir Rizvi, of the Pakistani army and whether there is a stance there that is diverging from the prime minister. Because hours before Prime Minister Khan spoke earlier today, the head of the army, General Qamar Javed Bajwa, had said that Pakistan wanted to expand its ties with Washington. So it seems like they don't want to jeopardize that relationship. Do you think that has to deal with the billions of dollars, maybe in military aid that the U.S., at least we know, has given Pakistan? Is that what this is about? Or why do you think that Pakistani army is keen on expanding its relation with Washington, I guess, diverging from the stance that Imran Khan has?
Well, you quite rightly pointed out that the army has a lot of support in Washington and has continued to enjoy armament deals and trade that have benefited the military extremely. However, I think the whole global dynamics in the last 4 weeks has changed so significantly that USA is a declining power, without any doubt. The whole issue of the dollar perhaps not being the reserve currency in the next 5 years or even earlier, and the relationship that is developing between Russia, Iran, and China. And the reality is that Pakistan is in the East. It's not in the West. Yes, it does trade with the West. Yes, it wants to have relationship with the West. But really, the future of Pakistan lies with the East.
I'll give 30 seconds to Lirat Ali Khan. Lirat Ali Khan, I'm sorry, Shabir Rizvi. Lirat Ali Khan, 30 seconds. Where is Pakistan headed to now, given what has occurred? Are we looking at instability in that country? 30 seconds, please.
Yes, I think the Supreme Court would reverse what Imran Khan has done. They would restore the National Assembly, and Mr. Khan would be de-seated from prime ministership.
Okay, thank you. We'll leave it there. Lirat Ali Khan, author, academic, and researcher from Topeka, Kansas. Thank you for your thoughts. Shabir Rizvi, managing director at IFSA London, who spoke to us from London, and at the top of our program, Kamran Yusuf, a correspondent, spoke to us from Islamabad. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kaveh Tafawi, and the entire team is goodbye. Until the next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining me in the studio today is our dear friend and guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Shaykh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Shaykh. Our topic today is a continuation of the previous session's topic, which was about the alteration of the Quran. The question is as follows: why are there differences in the recitation of the Quran? Isn't this proof of it being altered by human hands and thus corrupted? And does this not open the door for the alteration and rewriting of the Quran? Now, Sheikh, last time you mentioned that there were many different recitations, 14 in total, and also the other recitation, which was 10 in total, the famous recitations at least. And we got a bit of history on that, but we didn't get to answer why, in the first place, do we have so many different recitations. So maybe we should start with that, dear Sheikh.
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let me give you some examples of such differences, which can help us to talk about.
Just refresh our memory as well. Exactly. Right.
So, for example, in chapter Baqarah, verse 116, one recitation is قَالُوا اتَّخَذَ اللَّهُ وَلَدًا. The other is وَقَالُوا اتَّخَذَ اللَّهُ وَلَدًا. Only one wa and is the difference, which is not a big deal, of course. But some may claim that, yeah, it's a big deal. At the end of the day, one of them was revealed by God.
Right.
The other one is chapter Baqarah, verse 132, وَوَصَّى بِهَا إِبْرَاهِيمُ. The other recitation is وَأَوْصَى بِهَا إِبْرَاهِيمُ, which means the same, but from two variations of the root وَصَيَا. Chapter Ma'idah, verse 54, مَنْ يَرْتَدَّ مِنْكُمْ عَنْ دِينِهِ. The other is مَنْ يَرْتَدَّ مِنْكُمْ عَنْ دِينِهِ. Chapter Al-A'raf, verse 141, وَإِذْ أَنْجَيْنَاكُمْ مِنْ آلِ فِرْعَوْنَ, which means we saved you from Pharaoh. The other is وَإِذْ أَنْجَاكُمْ مِنْ آلِ فِرْعَوْنَ, when he saved you, that is God.
So the meaning is seemingly the same.
Almost the same, yeah. And chapter Al-Isra, verse 96, قَالَ سُبْحَانَ رَبِّي. The other is قُلْ سُبْحَانَ رَبِّي. He said, glorified is my Lord, or say.
Right, glorified. You say.
You say, yeah. These are some examples. But why we have such differences, we need to talk about that, which, I mean, help us in concluding that this has nothing to do with the concept of alteration of the Quran. Now, the first point is that what we call it nowadays as calligraphy, at that time, in those age, even in the second century after Hijrah, was in the, I mean, in its early age stage. So it was not like today that even we have all the vowels written and printed and everything.
Right.
Let me give you some examples. In that time, for example, Noon, which is similar to N, was written in a way that it was very similar to Re or Ra or R. Or, for example, in some cases, Wav and Ya were written in the same way. I mean, very similar to each other. I mean, I'm talking about the Kufi way of writing.
Right, the Kufi calligraphy.
Exactly.
Right.
Or in some cases, for example, two Ya were written separated from each other. I mean, when we have two following Ya's. For example, Yastahyi or Nastahyi, we have two Ya. One of the ways was to separate between these two Ya, not to connect them to each other. And all these later brought about such differences in reciting the Quran. And in some cases, Ya was omitted altogether. For example, Ilafihim was written like Ilafihim without the Ya being written. So that is why we have, for example, the recitation of لإلاف قريش and the other is لإلاف قريش, for example. I mean, I'm talking about the roots of such differences. The other is that we have what we call it تنوين. For example, when we say عليان, that نون at the end of it is like a تنوين, like two fathas together.
Right.
In some stages, Tanwin was written like a noon, not like two fathas. That is why even today we see in some of the, copies of the Quran, لَنَسْفَعَنْ بِالنَّاسِيَةِ, like written like a noon.
Right, they do not want the standard markers for the
Tanwin. Yeah, and some people write it this noon like a Tanwin, two fathas. Or لَيَكُونَنَّ مِنَ الصَّاغِرِينَ or لَيَكُونَنَّ مِنَ الصَّاغِرِينَ, we have the same. Like some people write it like noon and others like two fathas. In other cases, another reason which is also related to the calligraphy of Arabic language in that time, which is in its earliest stage, is that in some cases, Wav was omitted. When it was connected to the next word. Let me give you an example. For example, we have Salihul Mu'mineen, which is Salihuna, based on Arabic grammar, noon is omitted, and then we have Salihu al-Mu'mineen, but it is...